Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're here at the Hot Stove Society. I'm joined by my usual cohort, Chef Terry Rotureau.
Yes, hey, sir, Chef. Douglas. How are you doing today?
Awesome.
As always.
As always. Thank
it's the
so
same
much.
Thing with me. I'm always okay.
I mean, and also by KDO on the go.
Hello.
Hello. You were on the go this morning. You were helping out the Pacific Science Center.
Yes, apparently. It was their big fundraising breakfast. So we went and we gave a little money to the Pacific Science Center, which is a great place. I have certainly a lot of fond memories there growing up in the Seattle area as a kid, taking field trips over there. And they do a lot of great stuff for the community. So,
and you being, we gave money. Was that Hum Creative where you
That's
work?
Right. Hum okay. Creative. We're doing their whole like logo and rebranding process, really making their vision come back to life and revitalizing that whole look and feel. So we were there representing in full force this morning.
Good.
Good for you.
We have a. I am Chef Tom Douglas. I have several restaurants here in downtown Seattle. I also have this lovely cooking school that we're doing our show from, and a beautiful audience staring right at me. If you want to be part of our show, you can go to hotstovesociety.com and just spend 15 of your hard-earned dollars. How's that breakfast sandwich? Mine was a little chilly this morning, but it was delicious at the same time. Tom. I love the greens on there.
Mm.
It is nice. It makes you feel like you're doing something good for yourself early on in the day. Really putting
sauteed
in a nice
mushroom,
base layer.
Kale, and a sunny side up egg on a piece of beautiful bun.
When we do those eggs, we put a little veggie rub on from my rub line.
Mm-hmm.
Gotta say,
what's in that? What's in
rub.
That veggie rub, Tom?
It's a little fennel based rub, so it's pretty darn
delicious.
Very tasty.
Big show today. It's coconut cream pie. National Coconut Cream Pie Day on the 8th.
Ooh. Oh, boy. That's a big day for you.
And so if you want to come down to the Dahlia Bakery, we have a coconut cream pie eating contest. We have coconut cream pie specials. We have coconut cream pie hats and costumes.
So cute.
T-shirts. It's all about the pie this
it's
week.
It's all about that coconut cream pie.
That sounds so great.
You know, the cool thing about the pie is it's got this little cult following, which I love, right? It's super nice. But at the same time, when I donate it to different raffles and auctions and stuff, it raises a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. I've been to auction when that a pie alone raised $1,200.
Yeah, I've been to where they
raised some crazy
5,000.
Number for a pie.
By our calculations, we're at about $2 million that we've raised through our coconut cream pie.
Yeah,
and so I think that's really cool. And we're getting ready to team up with a company I can't announce yet because they haven't signed on the bottom line. But Coconut Cream Pie Citizen of the Month.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Just saying.
Very interesting.
Citizen of the month.
You can be
month.
A good person and win a pie. Who says there's no rewards, rewards?
I'm just more impressed that this pie has raised $2 million. Not a lot of pies can say that about themselves.
That's true.
I'm impressed.
I agree with that. Also, Kendall Jones is going to be here from the Washington Beer Blog. We're doing a hop as an HOP Stove Society dinner right here on May 11th, I want to say.
May 11th, 6
Stove
to 8.
Mm-hmm. Also, we're going to have a discussion on tips and how to manage food waste, your culinary quandaries answered, and of course we'll go toe-to-toe at the end of this two-hour show in our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge, which if I do say so myself, I kind of won last week.
Did you now?
You kind of did, yes you did.
Got to rub that in, don't you?
Well, whatever.
It's good. It's good to be a winner, for sure.
I still can't believe Twinkie would only last 2 weeks. That's crazy.
25 days, Chef.
Yeah, that's...
What did you think the package was going to say? What did you think the bakery was going to say? Oh, yeah, it lasts 5 years. You should
do not worry about this product. It will not leave you.
Yes. KDL, Ordinary to Extraordinary is where we'd like to begin.
Yes, that is where we like to begin. This is where you take some ordinary dishes and you make them extraordinary with your tips and know-how. So let's jump right into it. I've been having this on my mind lately because I'd really like to tackle it from square one, and that is chili. Chili.
When you say you'd like
so
to
cold?
Tackle it from square one, what do you mean by that? You have never made it?
I've never made it fully from scratch. And by that I mean getting the dried chilies, toasting them, grinding them, making my own meat mixture, et cetera, taking the beans from dry and rehydrating. Uh-huh. So that's where I'm thinking.
So why are you asking us? You just told us the whole process.
No, but how do you make it extraordinary? I just
you
gave
just
a rough,
did, making it from scratch.
I'll tell you what you could do is just chop a bunch of cilantro right at the end and toss it into there.
All right.
That would help
Yeah, just lose the can.
That's a good place to start. Make it from scratch. Yeah,
correct.
Tom, you seem like someone that makes chili. You seem like a chili kind of guy. Yeah. Am I making that up in my mind?
Totally. You're absolutely wrong. If I were to make chili, I'm more of a top round or some sort of chuck roast chili.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like ground meat chili so much. My dad loved that, and we had forced to eat Cincinnati chili noodles growing up.
Oh, like spaghetti noodles with chili.
Tom, you could use some ground venison or elk. That would be delicious.
No. Yeah. It's just horrible. It's just... my mom was so proud. She made it because my dad loved it. But I don't know that any of us actually liked it. It was terrible.
Force-fed.
I hope she's not listening right now. But I've never made it again.
Uh-huh.
And so I just have a bad thought about chili. But when I have had it that I like it, it's more like the chunks of meat done in a velvety kind of dried chili sauce. That's been dried chili rehydration situation, as
situation.
You millennials like to say. It's a dried chili situation. And you simply rehydrate them and puree them in 2 minutes. Wow, we've got to get on.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
I want to do quesadillas.
Okay, let's do quesadillas. Go ahead.
Well, I just think we have a super cool way to do quesadillas that makes them interesting over at the Cantina Lena.
Do tell. I haven't had them yet.
Really?
Yeah.
So we take the quesadilla, and this, you know what a quesadilla, right? Two tortillas. Typically flour,
cheese
in the middle. We do kimchi and smoked beef. So we have a smoked beef and kimchi quesadilla. But the trick is we put cheese, just crumbled cheese, onto the griddle, straight on.
Oh, and it's on the outside.
A little counterintuitive, right? Then you put your quesadilla on top. And as that cheese browns, it gets crispy.
Yeah.
And then you do, you know, you pick the whole thing up. All the cheese sticks to the quesadilla. You pick the whole thing up, put more cheese on, put the next side, turn it over. And you end up with this crunchy outside, deliciously crazy quesadilla.
Because it's all about the
that
cheese.
You can serve with that, what's that, guanchang? What's the name of that Korean
gochujang?
Gochujang, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that or sriracha or something of that nature.
That sounds delicious.
That is quite a situation, is all I'm saying.
I think that is extraordinary. Put that cheese straight on the griddle and get it nice and crispy on the exterior. Mm-hmm. Nice work, Kent.
Yeah, that's a nice idea. I like the idea.
And now people like it so much, we're doing that as a burrito finish, you know, for our breakfast burrito.
Oh, yeah.
Or any sort of thing like that. It's just a technique that nobody does. It's unique to us.
And we're all trying to get extra cheese on our food.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially browned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crispy cheese is good.
I would rather personally... Sean's giving me the hook. I don't like too much cheese in the center of my quesadilla. I just want it to be a nicely managed cheese portion. Up next, Kendall Jones is here from the Washington Beer Blog, and we're going to talk Hop Stove Society on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show, and I'm busy teaching Sarah all about musicals from our history. Really, the basis of civilized society is the American musical. So thank you very much, Sarah.
I've been uncivilized all this time. I'm glad to finally be making the corner on that.
I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
We're coming to you from the Hop Stove Society every week, Saturday and Sunday. Thanks for joining us. Kendall Jones is here from the Washington Beer Blog. And as you know, Terry, this is the Hot Stove Society.
Yeah.
And Kendall has renamed it for an event here called the Hop Stove
Society.
Just this clever switch of letters.
And see what I did there.
Yeah. Clever switch. And
very cool.
There we go. So, Kendall, you're a frequent contributor to our show. What's going on here?
Well, IPA is the most popular style of craft beer. Hands down, by far. Everybody loves IPA, but the problem with IPA is that it's difficult to cook for. It's hard to pair something with IPA because it's so hop-forward and it can be so bitter and have so many big, powerful flavors that it can overwhelm most dishes, and it just doesn't pair well with a lot of things. So I decided that what I wanted to do is I wanted to challenge a really great chef, in this case, your executive chef, to come up with some dishes to pair with four different IPAs. So we're going to do a class where people get to come in and they get to learn how to cook these dishes and kind of understand what the chef did to conceptualize these dishes to go with these IPAs.
So IPA in general to most novice palate would be considered bitter first?
Not anymore.
No?
Initially it was always, IPA used to be noted by its bitterness, but anymore it's more fruity and floral and citrusy, and the flavors are kind of all over the map, but the big thing is that they're hop-forward flavors,
right.
So they tend to be very pungent aggressive flavors, and that can be difficult to pair with food.
So I'm a chef, and I like to do matching, and it's very hard to match IPA flavor or hop flavor to anything because it's very forward and very strong. So
well, that's what he's saying. It's like the new hops, like the citron hop, I believe it
Citra.
Is. Citra hop is so lemony
right.
that you lose some of that bitterness when you're cooking. The problem you run into generally with cooking with is when you try to reduce the beer, like you're
right.
used to reducing red wine, right, or white wine for a sauce. You cannot reduce, in my opinion, IPAs.
Mm-hmm.
And IPA stands for India Pale Ale, and they use the hops. In the beginning, to cross the seas, right, to kind of preserve the
beer. Yeah, that was. It's kind of a which came first sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Some people say they made the beer this way with a very high hop content and a very high bitterness and hop acidity to survive the trip to India from England. But in reality, it was kind of more like they had this beer that was ready to go, and the ship was about to leave harbor. So they loaded the ship up with this beer, and it just happened to make it to India very successfully. And it became a very popular style of beer in India. And they said, well, maybe that's because it handled the trip so well.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't like they did not sit down and design a beer to handle the trip.
Mm-hmm.
They would have been happy just to continue to send porter to India at that point. But the brewer that they were dealing with had this other beer at the time, which was not what we called an India Pale Ale. It was more of a harvest ale. And the trip transformed it into something that's more similar to what we now call an IPA.
I can't imagine getting all the way to India and even having a drop of beer left.
Yeah, it's amazing.
What is that, like a 3-month trip or something like that?
This stuff must have been really nasty.
Yeah, and they must have had a whole lot of it.
Yeah. So this is coinciding with the Washington Beer Week.
Seattle Beer Week.
Which is the 10th to the 20th, right?
Yeah. There's 10 days in a brewer's week. Just like there's 13 in a baker's dozen, there's 10 days in a brewer's week.
Apparently there's 3 in a restaurant week.
Yeah.
And I know at Cantina Linea there's 2 weeks in a nacho week.
So, I need to know more about that.
Yeah,
for sure.
creative math here on calendaring with ours. So what else is going on? So that's the hop Stove Society dinner.
Yeah.
And things like, I'll just read off some of the dishes that, is it Lexi that created these?
No, it was Chef Schwartz.
Chef Schwartz, okay. So he's created 4 dishes paired with IPAs. So maybe if I'll say the dish and you talk about why you put a particular IPA with it, okay?
Okay.
So we have Cascade Creamery Glacier Blue with pea shoots, little sweet spring pea shoots. Prosser Farm Rhubarb, I had some last night in a tart. God, it was so good.
Mm-hmm.
It was just super red this time, which is odd for it being an outdoor rhubarb. And bacon fat toast.
So this all sounds very rich to me. Rich
yes,
and sweet.
I would agree.
And
yep.
The Fresh Off the Farm IPA, although I haven't had it yet this year, it's different every year. This is going to be the 5th anniversary edition of it. It hasn't even been, it's been released to the chef so he could taste it and make the beer, but I'm just the public out here, so I haven't got to taste it yet. But I would guess that he's looking for something that kind of really sharp to cut through that richness.
Uh-huh. And this is all coming from Bale Breakers Brewery, right?
Yeah, Bale Breaker Brewing
Yakima.
Over there in Yakima.
Okay. All right, so paired Fresh Off the Farm IPA. When I drive through Yakima, you can see, you know, I think Bale Breakers has 1,000 acres of hops over there.
Well, they're part of they're on a hop farm, and they're surrounded by Loftus Ranches, which is one of the big hop farmers over there.
Yeah.
But they're actually right out in the middle of a hop field. It's kind of a beautiful thing.
When I was talking to the dad of the young woman that's going to come do the dinner most likely, he said he had just planted 300 acres.
Yeah,
of hops.
Just 300 more acres.
You know what it costs to plant 300 acres of hops? That's like $9 million just to plant them. Because you have to put all the trellis in, the rope ties, all that sort of thing. Just planted 300. That's not even including the land.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up. That's one of the reasons why the Yakima Valley is such a prolific hop growing region, and it's one of those things where it is because it is, and it's an expensive thing to get started. So if you have a whole bunch of acreage out here randomly someplace and you think growing hops on it would be a good idea, there's huge infrastructure that has to be built up to make it a viable hop farm. And we just happen to have that over in Yakima.
Yeah.
So for somebody like Mike Smith, who you're talking about, to just add 300 more acres is not that big of a deal for him. But if you were going to try and just add 300 more acres to a farm out in Moses Lake or something, it'd be a completely different thing.
Exactly.
Okay, so it would be much more expensive on top of it.
Yes.
The next dish is purple varnish clams with Prosser Farm spring onions, lemongrass broth, fried lime leaf, and a little sorghum roti. So That's all over the map, but it's a little bit of a...
Well, it's got a little Asian twist to it.
We only have 2 minutes. Okay, so you have to go quick.
All right. Well, I think the lemongrass broth is going to pair with some of that citrusy, lemony kind of flavor that's going to be in the Leo de May IPA, which incidentally is named after the mother of Mike Smith, who you were just talking about.
Oh, perfect. All right, next course is Mishima Reserve Kulat Steak. So that's that five-star steak that Kurt Dammeyer is bringing to the area, bringing to the world, with charred Crawford Farm asparagus. We just got our first batch yesterday from Connie Crawford. Alaska King Crab, Skagit Valley Sorrel Hollandaise.
Now, the reason why I would pair that with the bottom cutter IPA is because I believe that one of the most important things to do with beer and food pairing is to pair a dish that you really love with a beer that you really love. And I really love that beer, and that dish sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's going to be... You thought the first one was rich.
Yeah, this is going to be a big rich dish.
And then we're
going to
finish out the evening. Newaukum Valley Farms Orange Leaf Mint Flan with peanut butter pecan cookie paired with Top Cutter IPA.
Well, once again, the Top Cutter IPA has got a lot of citrus notes in it, and I think that citrus is really going to help bring that mint flan, just make it pop.
Right.
Help you know, accentuate all of the flavors of the beer and of the flan.
You know, when I first did my first beer pairing dinner maybe 15, 20 years ago, this was hard for me. Now these young chefs, because they drink so much of this type of beer, there's a more natural,
right,
I think, extension into picking the foods that go with it.
Right, and their palate is much more suited for it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's May 11th here, a Hop Stove Society event, 6 to 8 p.m., $90 for dinner and all those beers.
It'll be a good time, I promise.
And Veil Breaker Brewery.
We'll be talking a lot about beer and drinking some of it, too.
Up next, we're going to talk a little bit about Maslow's, the Fair Start restaurant over in South Lake Union. On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's at the Hot Stove Society, and it's live on the tape. We are sitting here. It's KDO, Terry, and Tom, and we're sitting here being joined by Sarah Lorenzen. She is the chef over at Maslow's, which is over there in South Lake Union near my restaurants, the Brave Horse Tavern and Cuoco.
This is true. We're neighbors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm sorry you have to deal with that Wayne guy. He was on a few weeks ago. He's trouble.
I'll tell you. You got to keep your eye on him.
Yeah, exactly. Wayne is the executive chef over at the Fair Start School itself. Tell us about Maslow's. It's getting a lot of press. I know you've got a nice partnership with Amazon over there. It's one of their buildings, I believe, or at least one of their leased buildings.
We do. Amazon gifted us with about 25,000 square feet of space,
mm-hmm,
to expand the Fair Start program into some advanced training pieces. So Maslow's is a full-service restaurant. It's open 6 days a week. We do lunch and dinner. We're doing sort of New American, and we have an apprenticeship process that works both in the front and the back of the house, and then also in our other eateries there, that provides advanced training for folks in the industry.
Yeah. Great program.
So just a little recap. So Fair Start kind of starts that process, as it were, in terms of teaching people skills and getting back on their feet and getting into the world of restaurants. And then Maslow's takes that a step further.
We do. We're doing an advanced training piece. So mm-hmm, the folks that we're working with typically have been out in the industry, gained a few months of experience, and have realized that they want to expand their skill set. And our kitchens and our front of the house, the restaurant floor as well, are provide ways for them to pursue advanced training.
Hmm.
So when they graduate from Fair Start itself over here at 7th and Olive, is that right?
Virginia.
Sorry.
It took me a minute there.
You have all your lunches and dinners there too, right? So when they graduate there, it's a 6-week program or 16 weeks?
16 weeks.
16-week program. And they come out, and typically guys like Terry and I, we hire them, and they are trained to be, at that point, either dishwashers or prep cooks or generally beginning jobs.
Exactly, entry level.
Now they come work with us for 6 months, and in order for them to increase their wages at some point, they need to have this more high skill level job or a little bit of management training, and that's what Maslow's is doing. I think that's awesome.
Exactly. Yeah, we're trying to work on multiple pieces in our process of mm-hmm, apprenticeship. So we're working on a competency-based model where with each bit of advancement they have in their training, it kind of pushes them up a step. Some of the steps are through the prep kitchen and onto our line where we move them through a rotation of line work, which is really something that our industry, I know, is a little short on right now, so mm-hmm, we're hoping to to turn out some great cooks.
Right, and that's a very good point. I mean, it is very, very hard time right now in the restaurant industry to find cooks and to find professionals who have good training.
Yeah, so we're specifically working on that, and then also working on, again, the wage equality piece, trying to assist these folks in moving up in the industry into better-paying jobs.
Now, how does a chef jump in there? You're the chef there, right?
Yes, I am the chef there.
Yeah. So what's your day look like?
My day is pretty crazy, actually. It's there's a variety of things. We're refining the processes as we go and sort of meeting people where they're at and trying to refine our program pieces. And on a day-to-day thing, you're seeing the usual refining prep lists, doing menu planning and changing.
Food costing?
Definitely food costing. Mm-hmm. Definitely working on those sort of backbone pieces of restaurant work, I guess. Wow. But then, additionally, our menu planning sort of features ways that we can introduce techniques to folks. Maslow specifically works on producing a lot of things in-house, so we want to do strong butchery rotations and fish fabrication. We do most of our processing in-house as much as possible, so we're teaching sausage making, we're teaching pickling, lots of groundwork kind of pieces to really get good exposure.
Mm-hmm. Which is really cool, because when they're going to get in the workforce, you know, you say to somebody, can you make sausage? And they say yes. That's a serious step above the guy who cannot peel a vegetable.
This is true.
You know, I mean, that's really nice. It's very important, at least I feel it's important to me, and I'm sure Tom is the same way, to get people in the industry that can actually achieve some level of work, you know, without having to be babysit from the whole time. So
yeah, we want some really self-sufficient, strong players. That's what we're trying to cultivate and grow.
And if you're in the neighborhood and you're looking to have lunch or happy hour or dinner, how is it best for us as consumers and customers to participate at Maslow's?
Well, certainly as diners. Like, first and foremost, come and join us. All of the folks that are coming in there, not only will you have a great meal, you'll also be facilitating this training piece for Fair Start and for these apprentices, which is really lovely. And you get a good meal at the same time, which, of course,
that's always a benefit.
Appreciate.
Yeah, it's nothing like helping your community and also having a really great meal at the same time, for sure.
And it's interesting because you do front of the house and back of the house training, which is very, very important.
We do. We are working on also a bartending track. Like, so we're trying to cultivate these different places in our apprenticeship program that will fulfill jobs in the community, the places that the food and beverage or food and hospitality folks are looking for. In a front of the house rotation, you bus, you host, you expedite, you're a food runner, and then you go up to taking your own sections and managing your own tables as a server.
Uh-huh. Very cool. Can you tell us about Maslow's meal?
I would love to. So Fair Start obviously has a wonderful contribution from the chefs in the community. I know both you, Chef Terry, and Chef Tom are longtime supporters of Fair Start. And so to keep that continuity in what we're doing at Maslow's, we implemented a piece called Maslow's Meal. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we have a guest chef come in and create a meal that we serve at lunch and dinner that is a reflection on sort of like the family meal experience you have in the back of the house. If you're a restaurant employee, lots of folks get together before service, sit down and eat together. And that's what inspires Maslow's Meal. So we have guest chefs. We've had some wonderful people take part. Chef Thierry's Maslow's Meal begins on May 7th. So we rotate monthly. First Monday of each month, we roll out a new guest, Chef Maslow's Meal. And we really got to work with some great people. So
it's very cool. I was there yesterday, as a matter of fact, doing the testing for the... I'm doing Boeuf Bourguignon that's been featured the whole month on Maslow's menu. And it's really fun to be in that kitchen and have five apprentices around you, you know, constantly, like, eyes wide open, you know, and they just want to learn. They just want to see things, and they're in awe. And, you know, it's very cool. It's very, very uplifting.
It is.
You come out of 3-hour session at Maslow's and you're like, okay, that's cool. I did something good today. It's nice. It's a feel-good thing.
Very true. It's great for them to get exposure to different chefs in terms of the style and how they create and what their product looks like. So it's really exciting exposure for the apprentices and the staff as well. So it's a challenging thing in the industry. There's so much information, and I think as chefs grow, a lot of it is self-taught or self-researched. So having a guest chef in once a month to design Maslow's Meal and execute it is actually exciting, not only for the apprentices, but for our staff as well.
Oh, I guess I would, you know, I think Terry and I both know that being a chef is only about 25% on the food itself.
Right.
There's many things that a chef has to do. Number one, hire people, right?
Yes.
Get a brigade together that's going to complete his mission or her mission. There is food costing, right? If you don't charge the right price on the menu, you go out of business if there's no margin at the end of the day, right?
Yes.
So there's that. There's procurement, where you out are trying to find the best food at the price that you can afford and you think that your customer is willing to pay. It doesn't do me any good to go out and get Copper River King salmon at $60 a pound if my customer doesn't want to pay $60 a portion for it, right? So you have to understand that part of the business. And then facilitate the interaction in the kitchen, which I think has been under the microscope lately in the world of chefing, about how you treat your coworkers, how you treat young men and women, especially when you've, well, maybe not in your case, but in our case, at the end of the night when people have their shift drink or something of that nature. It's really an interesting time. How are you dealing with all that? That, or are you just focusing on the food?
No, no. It's
and we only have a minute, by the way.
Okay. We focus on all of that, and in places we're moving that through to an educational piece for apprenticeship. Like, for instance, in food cost, we're doing a lot to explain, you know, how waste affects us, trying to get good yields, working on portioning pieces. So much of the technical aspects of how you would manage a restaurant is included in their education. So hiring remains the same kind of challenge. We train. And so we're able to refine our training processes, as that's a specific goal of our kitchen. So we're executing that with our own chef, or with our own staff, rather, as well as the apprentices. Because when the apprentices are done, they've got to fly free.
Yeah.
They got to leave the nest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we want to really cultivate that and give them this great training experience with breadth and develop them well, and then we start the process over again. So.
And this, the other one is at Fair Start is 16 weeks. How long is this program?
This is, in the back of the house, it's up to 6 months. The rotations vary slightly.
Wow.
In the front of the house and the server training tracks, they're about 4 months.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What a great resource.
Nice job.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah Lorenzen, for coming by and sharing your story and the experience over at Maslow's. You can find them in South Lake Union, right off of Harrison and
Boren
Avenue. Up next, how to create less food waste on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Oh, it's such an exciting day around here today at the Seattle Kitchen Show here at the Hot Stove Society. We still have to come the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia.
That's
at the
right.
end of the show. You don't want to miss that.
I feel like you're feeling bolstered this week by last week's win.
Of course I am.
Riding that
and,
high.
And I'm feeling much better. It was 1 out of 5. It's not a contest.
You needed to recoup.
We're going to talk about, in segment two, cooking a whole hog, because that is just something that somebody wants to do. So we got a question on our Facebook page.
Yeah.
Why not? And then right now we're going to jump into how to create a little less food waste. And, you know, frankly, this is about you.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the consumer. This is about not throwing your hard-earned dollars into the compost bin and utilizing more of what you, when you purchase something, utilizing more of that product. And we've had this conversation about asparagus, right? So many people take the asparagus spear and they've been, the old wives' tale, you have to break it, and wherever it breaks is where the tender part starts. Nonsense.
Nonsense, yeah.
Nonsense.
I thought about you as I was peeling my asparagus just the other day.
Yeah. You don't need to peel the whole thing, but just peel that end and then cut off a little slice and see if it's woody. And then just cut up to where it's not.
That's right.
I would say you would save 50% off of your waste pile. So if you normally have an 8-inch spear of asparagus and you do that peel at the end, and typically I would say most people would, if they broke that, would be 3 inches. I bet you're down to 1.5 inches or so. Of waste. If that.
Yeah.
So.
And there's a lot of little tricks like that to be done, but
yeah,
we have
so
a list that we're going to go through right now about how you can just save a little bit more of that food and not be so wasteful. Tom, I know that this was a big pulpit of yours for a while, especially in restaurants we tend to see so much waste, but let's go into the first little tip here, which is keep your bread in the freezer and defrost by the slice as you need it. I've heard you talk about this before, but when it comes to whole rustic loaves. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, and I'll say there's two things about restaurant waste where you kind of started that conversation, which is one is there's something we can't deal with, right? Which is what the customer doesn't eat and sends back to the dish area, and that just goes into the compost bin or the pig bin or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's not something we can help, except I'm so frustrated with these restaurants that put these massive portions on a plate. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes 2,000-4,000 calories on a plate. And basically you're buying a doggy bag for the next day, and you're also just probably eating too much.
So now you're creating trash. You're going to put your food into a bag, you're going to take it home, put it in the fridge, and for 3 days you're going to watch it until you're going to feel better about putting it in the garbage.
So but I'm just saying, you know, chefs need to be more responsible about looking to see what's coming back, so maybe they're serving too large a portion, right?
Right.
And then use less.
We constantly look at that. I'm a tyrant when it comes down to being around the dishwashing area and looking at plate. I'm like, why is there so much left? What is it? They didn't like it? No, they loved it. I'm like, they loved it and they left a third of the plate. There's something wrong here.
Well, you're French. I mean, I swear, when I'm in France, the French people just stand at the table and they will not take my plate until I finish everything.
So. That's right.
And some cultures are like that.
Hello?
You ordered it, assuming that you're going to eat it. We made it, so you're going to eat it. And there's no waste.
You know, I like to order a lot of things.
This is waste in France.
Yeah. In Japan, if you eat everything, they think they didn't give you enough. So which is it?
Well,
just saying.
You just have to know the rules.
Getting back to the bread, yes, I do love. I like to invest in good bread, and it is an investment, right? When you get a great hearth-baked artisan loaf of bread now, it can be $6-7.
Oh, yeah.
And so I like to invest in that, and then I take it, I slice it into toast-size pieces, and I put it right back into a Ziploc or something of that nature, and pull it out, just the frozen slices, when I'm ready to make a piece of toast, or ready to make croutons, or ready to make breadcrumbs.
I was going to say, that's my favorite, is processing it and freezing it and having breadcrumbs always at the ready for topping pastas or even in little salads or what have you. But yes, I think using all of the loaf that you've spent all that money on, because it really isn't cheap, but it's a great investment, because good
plus
bread
it's
is
well
delicious.
Made, it's good quality food. You there's no reason to put it away. You have a freezer, use it.
Yeah.
This next one feels a bit like a pro tip, because I think that you really keep track of something like this in restaurants when it's your business, which is keeping track of the food you throw away and adjusting your grocery shopping accordingly. You see this a lot in bakeries, right? They keep track of their pars, how many croissants they throw away at the end of the day, so that they can readjust for the following day. Is this something that you apply to your own lives?
Yes, especially with lettuces and fresh herbs. You know, you buy lettuces. If you buy two heads of lettuce and you end up throwing one every week in the garbage or in the compost bin, just buy one. Don't buy two. You know, and or process your greens as soon as you get home. So the herbs, just cut the bottom part of the herbs with a pair of scissors, put it in water, cover it up. It will last 10 times longer. So now you have enough time to use the product. Same thing with your lettuce. Process it. You know, you cut the bottom, you wash it really cold water, you drain it, and then you put it into a nice bag with a little paper towel in it so it still has a little moisture. This lettuce will stay crisp and much longer alive.
Mm-hmm. All right, this next one. Make a shopping list before every trip after planning your meals for the week. Tom, I don't feel like you do
this. Not a chance.
This is not for you.
We're not going to plan for
the
week.
I'll go back to the question number two. And I'd be curious, what's the number one thing you buy at the grocery store that you end up throwing away because you didn't use it? To me, it's something personally that you're going to wait for it to ripen, and then all of a sudden...
Oh, gosh.
Bananas?
I'm that way with mangoes. Like, I'm just waiting for that perfect mango day, and it must be like the 6 hours when I'm not home.
Yeah.
And then it's all weird.
I am constantly throwing away avocados that I've spent too much money on.
Oh, and those are expensive,
too. Yeah, $3 for an avocado yesterday at the grocery. It was a big avocado, but I bought it because, like, you want to have it. Jackie loves avocado toast in the morning. But I know it's just, she just left for the farm this morning. I know it's not going to get eaten. I'm going to throw it away on Friday.
That sad, sad avocado.
Yeah, $3 right in the garbage.
Mm-hmm. You need to go home and make some guac.
Since he knows that, the best thing would be to try to remember to bring it to the office and give it to one of the person in the office to have for lunch tomorrow.
Yeah, you are correct, chef.
That is very true.
I'm just saying.
Chef. I would also say, I'm going to add a tip here really quick. Don't go to the grocery store hungry. Even if you make a shopping list.
Yes.
You will diverge from that shopping list so quick. If you are ravenous, you're just going to buy weird stuff.
It is worth buying a sandwich before you go to the market.
Yeah, most
it will be the best thing you've ever done.
The other day, I was so hungry, I bought 10 bags of beef jerky.
10 bags of beef jerky?
They were on sale.
Are you going to go on the Oregon Trail? Where are you going with 10 bags of jerky?
10 bags. Are you serious?
They were like 25 cents off. Oh, I'll take 10. It's like...
Are you going to put that in your snack drawer? I don't know if everyone knows this. Tom has a very good snack drawer by his desk.
I can't wait for the party.
Yeah, I used to dig in that snack drawer all the time. For
I have a new favorite
like
jerky, though, just saying.
Really? Would you like to give him a shout-out?
It's called Chef's Cuts.
Chef's
Cuts. Anyone tried that yet?
Yeah.
It's an old caddy that decided he made jerky to bring out to his player to keep him proteined up and... the player said, this is really good. We should do something. So he invested, and they did it, and now it's a national brand, and I want to say just sold for $500 million.
And you got 10 bags of it.
Yeah.
I guess he's not a caddy anymore. He's a player.
He's a jerky magnet.
He's a jerky man.
He
owns the golf course now.
We have 1 minute left. Do you think we have time for one more tip?
Sure.
Yeah.
Don't be scared to buy the ugly fruit and vegetables as they're most likely to be wasted. There's imperfect produce, which I hear so much about. Mm-hmm. My office actually subscribes to it. It's not the most beautiful fruit and vegetables, but I'll tell you, very tasty.
Very tasty. Yeah, it's probably ripe.
Exactly. Yeah. It's where it should be at this point.
Exactly.
I was at Central Market the other day, and they actually had ripe pears.
Or bananas. When you see ripe bananas... Exciting.
That's another way to not have to throw away so much, because when you buy it and you have to wait for it to ripen, then you're out of the mood for it when it actually happens.
That's right.
Get other things, like life got in the way. Mm-hmm. Tina Noll, our producer, has eaten her way through Vancouver. That's where she is right now. So she's going to tell us how it went, what was her favorite bites up there in the our Vancouver to the north. That would be Vancouver, B.C. on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Oh, Canada. Welcome back to Seattle Kitchen. I'm producer Tina Noll. So last week, I was invited to Vancouver, BC to check out a new floating lodge. It's called the Ocean House, and it's literally a hotel that floats on the water. It was temporarily parked just outside of Gastown in BC. Soon, it'll be making its way to its permanent home in Haida Gwaii, which is a series of islands just off the coast of BC near the Alaskan border. Haida Gwaii is a cultural destination, and it's quite beautiful. There are some places you can stay there now, but Ocean House is the only one that is literally on top of the water. If you want to know more about it, I'll post a bunch of stuff on Seattle Kitchen's Facebook page. So after a lovely visit and tour through the Ocean House, it was time to explore BC. And the only way, as far as I'm concerned, to see a city is to eat your way through it. And who better to do that with than a foodie? I met up with Leslie Kelly. You may know her from our show, but she's also a contributor to Seattle Magazine, and she writes for Sip Northwest. We spent our day exploring some restaurants, and we were pretty tired, so we ducked into a beautiful Japanese garden, and that's when I turned on the mic. I gotta tell you, if you're going to spend a few days away, the person to do it with is a food writer in a foodie town like this one.
Vancouver is just so amazing. Every time I come up here, I'm like blown away by how much there is. It's almost overwhelming. I have some favorite spots. Of course, everybody goes to Veges, and I absolutely love that spot. You have to get there at 5 o'clock because it opens at 5:30 and there's already a line waiting to get in because it is the most famous Indian restaurant in North America. And rightly so. Vikram Veej, you know, is a chef, and he really elevated Indian cuisine to a very modern, sophisticated place. And you have to order the lamb lollipops. They're like lamb chops that are basted with Indian spices, and they are so incredibly good.
One of the things that's interesting about Vancouver is the uniqueness of food I'm finding here. Like, I have yet to find, like, sort of the quintessential BC Canadian food because there's so much diversity in this town.
Well, I mean, there's poutine everywhere. You know, those gravy-soaked fries. I mean, that's really more of a Quebec dish. But I think that is what's so beautiful about Vancouver is that it's like... There is this global richness here, and you can go to a section of town, and you can walk down a block, and you can see five different sushi places. I ate at a sushi place last night in Yale Town, and it was spectacular. I had some fish that I had never tried before, sea bream, mackerel, some other really exotic fish, and it was just couldn't have been fresher, and it was a really lovely atmosphere, very casual.
Additionally, earlier today we visited a place called Gringo's that was quite delicious.
I loved Gringo. It was not unlike a taco shop that you would find in Southern California, really. What my favorite was probably the brisket with the slaw and then crunchy onions on top. I think you liked the pulled pork, right?
I loved the pulled pork, and I also thought they did a very unique take on guacamole that had some other little spices in there. It wasn't your traditional it was not simple. So that's a nice spot to check out in Blood Alley Gringo.
And because we, don't think about food 24/7, we decided to get a little culture and come to the Sun Yat-sen Chinese Gardens, and it is a really beautiful place in the middle of the city. It's very serene. It's very peaceful.
Totally. And we were not allowed to bring food. We weren't supposed to bring any food in, but we did it anyway. What did you bring me?
We snuck in a piece of fried chicken, Southern fried chicken, from this place in Chinatown called Juke, as in juke joint. That's a very Southern thing. And I lived in the South for a while. I really am a fried chicken snob. So whenever I go to a new fried chicken place, I go there with a lot of skepticism. And this place really came through. The coating is very crispy. The meat is juicy. The flavor is great. And they have homemade pepper sauce and hot honey sauce to drizzle on top. So good. Do you want to try a bite?
Yes. Let's try a bite right
Do
now.
It. Do it.
Mm. Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Okay, we have a few minutes before we get kicked out of the botanical gardens for bringing
contraband chicken.
Totally. I do have to say that after eating your way through Vancouver, a nice way to walk it off and chill out and get out of the city is to spend some time in a beautiful Chinese garden, which is where we are sitting now before we go and get dessert somewhere or coffee at your place, Revolve.
Revolver, yeah. Love Revolver. They make a pour-over to order, and it's just really delicious coffee. I also love the tea service there. That's in Gastown. And I bet you didn't know there's one of the last standing old spaghetti factories in Gastown. It's still chugging along. But Gastown, there's a really cool place to get a drink. It's called the Diamond, and it's upstairs. It's kind of like a speakeasy atmosphere. Another place that I love to go get a classic cocktail is the Sylvia Hotel, the Sylvia's Bar at the Sylvia Hotel over on English Beach. And that is an incredible place to people watch and watch the sun go down and just, be very happy that you're alive in the city of Vancouver.
Yep, and all of that can be done in only a 3-hour train ride from Seattle that is quite lovely on the Amtrak. A very easy way to get into Vancouver and explore BC and walk. You can walk everywhere in this town, so it makes it quite a fun little spot to visit right outside of our city. Super fun hanging out with Leslie Kelly. Don't forget to follow her Instagram, LeslieDines58, because she's just about to embark on an epic journey around the country with her husband, and you're not going to want to miss their foodie adventures. And here's a tip. Though I took the Amtrak, which was incredibly lovely, from Seattle to Vancouver, it only takes about 3.5 hours, goes right along the water, and it's really beautiful. But let's say you don't have that much time. There is something new in town. Harbor Air Seaplanes is now offering a round-trip flight from Lake Washington or Lake Union right to Vancouver from right here, from Seattle. Super easy. To find out more about that, check out harborair.com, harborair.com, and enjoy Vancouver. I'm Tina Knoll. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Up next, your culinary quandaries answered.
Are you having fun yet?
Yeah.
All right. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society. I'm having fun. Katie O?
I'm having a good time.
Yeah?
I'm having a blast in my corner here.
Yeah?
No.
You're back from Maui. What do we care about you?
Exactly.
We're all just anger issues with you right now.
I'm not back. I'm just thinking about it.
Just
very
jealous.
Strong.
Just haters.
You're physically here, but not mentally.
I can still
here.
Smell it. Oh.
Okay. KDO.
It is time for questions from our listeners. Mm-hmm. This is where we look at our beautiful live audience and ask if they have any questions. And we also go to our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen. So if you have questions for any of us, feel free to head on over there right on our page, and we will try to answer it here on the show. But first, we have an audience member. Tell us your name.
Lisa.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for joining us today. Are you an avid cook?
I cook.
Very confident.
Well, do you enjoy it?
I think I wouldn't say that I'm. It is an art, right?
That's
and I
right.
am not an artist, mm-hmm. but I'm really good at picking out recipes.
I think that's part of the artistry, though. You've got a talent for picking out good recipes, and I'm assuming that you then go and cook those recipes.
I do.
So you're putting in the time.
I am.
I like.
But I'm
that.
Not creating them.
That's okay. Here you are, though. You have a question. What's your question for the chefs?
Since it's asparagus season and we just talked about food waste, mm-hmm. my question is it better to snap the asparagus, you know, the end and let it break at its natural point mm-hmm. or to actually trim it with a knife?
The consensus was that you peel maybe an inch or two or three of the end, right, before you do anything, before you break it. And then you cut off the end, maybe a half inch, and you taste it. You put it in your mouth and taste it. If it tastes kind of woody and stringy, you cut off another half inch, right? And at some point, it's going to not be woody and stringy anymore. Mm-hmm. And what I've noticed is that a lot of times, the bunch of asparagus that you get is very similar. It's from the same field, from the same pick, generally. Right? So then whatever that spot, that good spot that you get to, because it's been peeled, the stringiest part is the outside that you've peeled off.
Right.
But sometimes the inside can get woody, too. That's what you have to check.
On an old asparagus, yeah. Older. Yeah.
But that's...
Also, if they haven't been sitting properly at the store. Like, most of the time, they'll be sitting in water. Sometimes that water doesn't get refilled, so you don't have a fully hydrated spear. Mm-hmm. So what Tom's saying is if you don't want to stick raw asparagus in your mouth, there's no problem with it. You can actually cut it and see as well, you know, whether it's kind of hydrated or if it's dehydrated, how woody it looks. But
and you can rehydrate it yourself by cutting the ends and setting it in water.
Most definitely. And I think what we're saying is like that snapping technique is kind of a bit of a wives' tale. I mean, it's going to snap kind of wherever that pressure is, and it has really not much to do with the you know, deliciousness of that spear.
Right.
Yeah.
Especially if you're snapping without peeling the bottom first.
Exactly.
Is there anything you can do with that woody part, that part that you would...
Compost bean. That's what it does. Hey, the worms like it too.
No, that usually you're probably right on that.
Totally the end of it, like the 1 inch that you're gonna cut off. No, it's not. You could, I guess, if you were making a soup, you could throw it in there and not care. You're just gonna have to blend it and strain it much more because that's really a stringy hardwood part. That doesn't really give any flavor because mm-hmm. it's dried out.
Yeah.
So it's not really no. It's this is when you can use your compost bean.
Mm.
All right. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
All right. Up next, we have a question from our Facebook page. This comes from Angie Inselman Battle, and she'd like to know, there are so many sizes, types, and flavors of sea salt for the market these days, and I'm just never quite sure which one to use where. I have 14 different kinds at home. Kind of a pretty saltaholic, I guess you could say, but I'm never quite sure if I'm using them correctly. Would love some help. 14 types of salt. She's clearly into salts.
Yeah, I thought I was crazy, and I have about 5 different kinds in my mm-hmm. cupboard right now. So, I mean, salt is, to me, I think it's very interesting to see the amount of salt that has come on the market, mm-hmm. The different kind. You should do a tasting. See what they taste like first, because you're going to find out that there's a lot of salt that's not very different. It's just different in shape, different in color, but it's not really different in flavor. Ultimately, salt is... sodium, that's the dehydrated part of the water, mm-hmm. salted water. So, you know, you're going to find out there's a lot of similarity in salt. It's very hard. I've done many salt testing. It's very hard to distinguish flavor in many salts. However, there are some salt that are different. The Murray River salt, the pink salt that you find on the market commonly, is different in flavor than the Hawaiian black sea salt. Those are a little bit different in flavor. Mainly the intensity is where the difference comes in.
I think
the
Yeah, I was going to say, I think a lot about texture with this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So, Tom, maybe you can talk about texture and salt.
Well, texture is kind of where you want to use these other specialty salts when you're finishing a salad to have that nice Maldon flake. Mm-hmm. You get the little crunch
really delicate.
In your mouth. Yeah. The Hawaiian black sea salt is really fun to see on creamy butter, right? Mm-hmm. So then it's a visual. So there's just not a ton of difference. And the salts that I use the most probably are manipulated salts. Like, I love to keep smoked salt around because it helps me get just a little bit more of a charcoal grill flavor without having to use that. You don't really, it's not super strong, but but you get a little layer of flavor out of that, or a truffle salt to finish something that I'm doing with mushrooms. Or
do you think Angie has a big block of that Himalayan pink salt
that she cooks on? I don't know. I hope so.
I hope so, too, if she's a saltaholic. All right. The next question comes from Megan DeFilippio. I believe I said that right, hopefully. She says, my uncle goes to Alaska to fish a few times a year and is generous with the fish he returns with. The one I have a hard time cooking is black sea bass. I have followed 2 to 3 different recipes, and they were all a flop. Any suggestions on the best way to prepare it?
Wow. I wonder what she means by what she did to make it a flop, because it's... Black sea bass is a pretty giving fish. I mean,
it's bony.
It can be very bony. Yeah.
The way I've done it in the past, because I like the fish to fall off the bone, so it's not a fish that I want to cook even medium rare,
right?
Because then you have to kind of work to get the fish.
It's all the way through.
So I like to make a little court bouillon and do a little poach on the black sea bass. And you poach it low and slow all the way.
Yeah, no boiling.
And it's cooked all the way through, just like a canned tuna is cooked all the way through, right? But then that fish will fall off the bone, and it's easy to separate. Not quite as easy as gefilte fish, but, it is,
but
that is massacred.
Where you can actually eat the bone.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
That's what I would do, is give it a slow poach.
All the way through. All right. This next question comes from Rob Woodard, and he wants to know, this summer I want to do a whole hog. I need to do a practice run and was hoping for some tips and tricks or suggestions so I am successful.
So I wonder what he's going to use for practice run.
I don't know, but if I was Rob, I would. There's these kind of plywood boxes called. I think they're called China boxes. And you take a butterflied pig, basically, and put it on the rack, put it into the box, and you build a fire on top of the box in the fire on the fire lid. Put all your charcoal up on top of there. And it makes a beautiful pig. We use it for catering all the time. These boxes probably are $400, but it's a, you know, we've had ours for 10 years. That's $40 a year.
It's a great investment if you're going
to
do this regularly.
Well, you have
or
to
not
have space
even regularly,
too, right?
But
yeah,
so.
You need space. Backyard space.
I think it's super fun, and believe me, when your guests come over and see that thing working, and you pull the lid off, and you have that crunchy skin on top of the pig.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful, and it's lovely.
Nobody
it's
walks away. No, I agree.
Nobody goes away unhappy.
I remember you did a goat one time in one of those, and it was also equally delicious.
You know, it's just like a hot box, essentially. Yeah. The odd part is there's no wood in there, right? The charcoal's on top of the box, outside of it. So there's really no smoke flavor. It's just really kind of cooking and steaming
at the same time,
in its own juices,
They're beautiful.
Sean's giving us the hook there.
Okay.
Video. Up next, Chef Brittany Bartolabin from the Dolly Bakery is going to join us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
And I'm Katie O.
And I'm Tom D. My golf buddies call me Tankard 5.
What does that mean?
Tankard 5. That means that when I'm in Scotland with them playing golf, they all drink beer, and I drink the same amount in whiskey.
Whoa! Like a pro.
Because I'm not a beer guy. So, but they serve them over there in my club. They serve them in these little steel goblets that are called tankards. And I had 5 one evening. And, you know, over there you drink in the locker room. You have dinner in the locker room if you want.
Sure.
And I ended up giving one of my buddies a lap dance, apparently. So.
Oh, my God.
So I now have the name Tankard 5.
Is there footage of that?
There is a picture of it.
So does your golf game get better with all this whiskey? Or how?
Well, it's not very good to begin with. So I would say better. It depends on the morning, on the time of the morning. Like when I'm first out in the morning after 5 tankards, then I'm like unconscious and everything's cool.
Everything's
great.
But
as soon as I can think again, my golf game skills.
Once you come to, yeah, and you look at the scorecard.
No, and then you just think, oh, I'm going to do it like this, or I'm going to do it like this. And it's like everything goes.
Oh, you overthink it.
You're not natural anymore.
Yeah, you're not. You're not in the moment.
I think it's the secret of golf. You got to be so relaxed and mellow.
Be so drunk.
To perform.
You got to be so
so drunk.
Anyway, who knew we were going to get into a story of Tankard about, Five?
And golf. Right, exactly. You came here to talk about baking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Chef Bartleman is here, and there's a couple of things we have to talk about. One is, that's very serious, there's a proposal to close the baking department of the South Seattle Community College, the whole baking program.
What?
Which I believe you might be a graduate of.
I am a graduate. Several people that work for this company or have worked for this company are graduates. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic program.
Yeah, it is a great program.
Yeah, I'm going to go to the meeting today and write all kinds of letters after the meeting and do whatever I can to make it.
Is it because, what's your name,
funding, I'm going to find out exactly what their reasons are today.
I thought the meeting was tomorrow. Is it today?
It's today.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could you email that to me? That would
absolutely
be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Very sad. It's a really, really great program. And it's affordable. And, I mean,
it's got to stay.
Yeah, it's got
to stay. That's the thing. It's affordable. It's a vocational program, which is something I think, you know, so often I think kids are forced to think that they have to go to college rather than do a vocational school or something. And, I honestly think that I can't imagine what it's a standard in the country, this particular program at South Seattle Community College. So I'm curious if it's really funding, if they can just raise the money, raise the price of it, or if it's actually there aren't enough kids enrolling in it.
Yeah. And I will say, if you're interested in pastry, you got to go to school. There's a lot of science you need to learn. It's not, I mean, on the savory end of things, there's a lot you can learn on the job. Same with pastry, but there's some basics and fundamentals you just need to learn.
I think more pastry than cooking needs some sit down and read.
Science, there are laws that must be followed, and so, school is very important.
So if you or anyone that you know is interested or has been to South Seattle Community College, the baking program, you're obviously going to miss the meeting that's today, but you can certainly get a hold of the school to throw your support behind this program.
Yes.
I know, you know, here we are. We raise money every day for Fair Start to get people off the streets and into vocational programs and to get them a job skill. This is doing the same, but at a much higher level. You come out making much more money. And why are we getting rid of this? I don't
know. We're going to do what we can.
I'm going to find out more, and we'll keep you up to date on our Facebook page. But let's save the South Seattle Community College Bakers Program.
Yes.
All right. Now into our subject today.
Yes.
Cooking with herbs.
Yeah,
baking with
desserts. Herbs and desserts.
Herbs and desserts.
One of my favorite things to sneak into a
Is
dessert.
Is it really?
Yes,
I did
absolutely.
Not know that.
It's a year-round. There's a plethora of things to work from, but especially this time of year coming up.
Now, the only one I have that I know of, and of course I made the recipe, that's why I know it, but we have the cornmeal cake with the rosemary fondant with the lemon zest in it.
Oops.
I love that cake.
It's great.
That's in, I think that's in two books, right? Isn't that in the Thomas Big Dinners and in the It Made It to the Bakery book?
I think it made it to the bakery book as well. The pine nut, my hands-down all-time favorite Tom recipe is your pine nut marzipan tart.
Ah, it's pretty good, isn't it?
Oh, it's so good with rosemary ice cream. Mm. Rosemary and pine nuts just play beautifully together.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, and rosemary is great in the wintertime to just wake up the palate a little bit. It pairs beautifully with apples, dried fruits,
just
nuts.
Just put the right amount.
Yeah,
don't
yeah,
put too much.
Absolutely. Oranges.
And while we're on rosemary, let's talk about that for one second, because that's a strong herb.
It is a strong herb.
I know on that particular cake and in that particular fondant, we actually blanch it first to kind of take away some of that.
Pull it back a little.
Yeah, just kind of get some of the pininess out of it.
Yes, exactly.
And also, these kind of herbs need to be chopped really fine. So you don't end up with a big chunk of rosemary.
Because
a chunk of rosemary. Yeah. You know, when you go
unpleasant.
To a restaurant and they give you a branch of rosemary on your plate, I'm always like, who's going to eat that? I ain't no squirrel.
While we're on the topic of winter herbs, sage is a fantastic thing to pair with. Just like in the savory world, pairing it with squash, infuse your cream with sage and then make caramel sauce.
Yep.
A sage caramel with pumpkin pie is just a
delight. How good does that sound?
That sounds delicious.
Sage caramel with pumpkin pie.
Doesn't that sound good?
You just gave me like goosebumps. That's awesome.
That does sound good.
Do you use bay leaf?
Oh, do I use bay leaf? I love bay leaf. Yes, that one's a great one to use any time of year, but I especially like it with apples. Pineapple, it's a really good time.
If you make a pound cake, simple recipe like a pound cake, you just put a few leaves on the cake.
On top. Looks so
and
pretty.
It really perfumes the cake.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah. Plums. I could make, I almost feel like we have to have a separate show for each herb.
Well, let's go back to a couple of maybe techniques then. So
yes.
if you're want to scent a whipped cream,
mm-hmm.
right? And that can be done in a lots of different ways. But how do you go about scenting a whipped cream?
Like, so
you'll see on our menus bay whipped cream
right,
or
yeah.
blah, 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 right?
Rosemary, so. Yeah, any of it. Lemon thyme.
Mm-hmm.
What we do, actually, is we make a simple syrup out of the herb. And that's a really great way to preserve it because you can make a big batch and then freeze it. And
right.
then that syrup is going to sweeten your whipped cream.
So you use that syrup instead of, say, powdered sugar in your
exactly.
whipped cream?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. So what we do is we take sugar, water, and whatever herb we're using. Hardy herbs are really good for this because they don't break down and get bitter.
Right.
Lemon thyme, bay,
they
rosemary.
They also give more flavor.
More
out.
Flavor. Mm-hmm. So we're going to combine all of that on the pot or in a pot and just cook it to soft ball, which is going to be about 275 degrees or just before the sugar looks like it's starting to candy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just add a little bit of cream just to stop the cooking process and then strain it. And you've got this sort of opaque, kind of greenish looking thick, very strongly flavored.
Great for meringue too.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Syrup. And then that's what you're going to use as your sugar. And you can use that in whipped cream, ice creams.
When do you put it in your whipping process?
You add it with the cream and then just.
So in the very beginning.
In the very beginning. Mm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I was wondering about that, if
yeah.
that breaks down that kind of fluffing process.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
And it's a really great thing if you've maybe just got a little pot on your, you know, on your kitchen window.
Mm-hmm. Not like a little pot, but a little.
If you just got a little pot.
Yeah.
That's a whole other.
That's a whole other segment.
Yes. Another
yeah.
day.
So where do you put the pot?
But if you're like me, you just have a little bit, and you don't. It doesn't last all year, and you
right.
just want to, you know,
it's not
harvest
any different.
A lot
than, it's not any different than keeping the fat, the rendered fat
yeah.
on your counter. You keep one with syrup, and
exactly
those syrups
yeah.
stay for a long time.
For a long time,
they
a
don't
year
go bad.
In the freezer.
You know
freezer.
That quickly,
yeah. So you can enjoy your.
You keep a syrup on your counter?
Yeah.
No, I keep a pot of herbs on my counter.
Oh. Okay. Well, you were saying keep the syrup on your counter.
I would keep my syrup.
Sorry.
No. I would keep my syrup.
Okay,
out.
So we only have 2 minutes. So okay. another technique for herbs that you do.
You can also chop it up into a sugar. So if you're using more of a tender herb, such as lemon verbena, that you don't want to turn bitter when you're cooking it, just take the fresh leaves, put it in your food processor with some sugar, and grind it up, and it will pulse up through the sugar, and then you just freeze that sugar.
Right.
And then you can use that sugar to make a cake or a whipped cream.
So now let's say you have a polenta cake and you throw a little rosemary sugar in there.
Delicious.
It's the same thing.
It's
as,
the same thing.
Yeah,
yeah you have
yeah.
a nice extracted flavor
yes,
already. So.
Exactly. And gosh, if you get your hands on some lemon verbena, it's mm. it's like Fruit Loops. It's mm-hmm. the best thing ever.
It's actually
yeah.
a very easy thing to grow,
yeah.
too.
Yes. We it had a huge really well. Bush in my yard growing
yeah.
up. Yeah.
Lemon verbena.
Yes.
I don't
yeah.
know if we have any at the farm.
That's get some.
I was going to say, you know someone.
The
yeah,
Prosser
exactly.
has some amazing, there's great sweet herbs that people don't think to use. Sweet Sicily.
Chervil.
Star, yeah.
Tarragon.
Anise hyssop. Oh, God, anise
hyssop. Anise hyssop is such
oh,
a good,
yeah.
that's
yeah.
one of my favorites.
Heaven. It's so delicious.
The other thing I think to translate is shiso.
Yes,
translates
absolutely.
To desserts in a beautiful
yes,
way.
Yes, really. So good. Yeah.
Like a,
yeah.
a fresh plum and shiso tart
yes.
or something like that would
yes.
be
one
very nice.
One of my
nice.
Favorite herbs.
So
I can
good.
See that being so nice
yes,
in a dessert application.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And roses and, you know.
Rose well, geranium, yeah. lavender. Yeah, we could go.
Rose geranium. Now, that's an animal.
you,
that is intense.
Bit. Yeah.
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 That can really take
yeah,
over
you,
a dish.
It really
this is
can.
A perfect thing
yeah.
to make syrup.
Yes, exactly.
Make syrup that's on flavor.
Oh, be so conservative with it.
All right. Thank you, Brittany Bartleben.
Thank you.
Thank you, chef,
yeah.
at the Dahlia Bakery. You don't have anything to do with those breakfast sandwiches, do you?
Eating them. That's
we had
about
a good
it.
Batch this morning.
yeah. yeah. I saw there's some up for family meal. I'm going to get back.
All right. up next, it's our favorite Food for Thought Tasty Trivia on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. Thanks for hanging with us this whole 2 hours. Our audience is worn out. They're
I mean, they've had the sandwich, the coffee, and with us for 2 hours.
Thank you for being such good participants today. Katie, it's time for our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge.
That's correct.
And are you playing today?
I am playing today. So that means our production assistant, actually manager, production manager today, Ooh. Sarah Leibovitz, is going to take over the duties of being quiz master. Sarah, wow. take it over.
That's right. You all know how this goes. I'm going to ask you each 5 questions. The person who gets the least correct is the loser, which means they are giving someone away. Or someone. No, something.
I'm giving away Tom.
I'm with you. I'm going to give Tom away this time.
All right. We're giving away Tom this time.
Trying to get rid of me.
And we're going to give it away to Lisa this week for being so brave and coming up and asking a question. We are going to be giving away things for Lisa. Katie, if you lose, what are you going to be giving away?
Oh, Lisa, I would like to give her a little happy hour situation, as we call it, for two to Palace Kitchen. Love that spot. So $75, get some cocktails, a couple glasses of wine, a little snack or two.
Sounds delicious.
Have a blast.
Lisa's going to be on her hands and knees on their way out of there. But, oh, my God. $75
okay,
for the cocktails.
Maybe just some soda water and a lot of food.
Yeah,
who knows?
There you go.
I'm going to give away, you know, we're talking about asparagus so much today. I'm going to give away a rainbow platter for two at the Carlisle Room. We have, you know, tons of vegetables at the Carlisle Room, along with our other things. But we took the 5 that we love the most, and we made a platter, like a smorgasbord out of them. Right. $75 to the Carlisle Room.
Wow.
For the rainbow platter.
Mm. Lisa,
or if you hate
been...
vegetables, Lisa, you can have whatever you want.
Have Lisa, have you been to Lule yet?
I have not.
All right. Branch
Lisa, do you
four.
Want to go to
Branch
Lule?
Branch for four.
Ooh.
On a Saturday or Sunday at Lule.
The oohs and ahs from the crowd on that one. My goodness.
I'm not gonna tank today. I'm just gonna I always try to tank so I make you guys feel better, but not today.
You're fighting for it.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, let's see who does the best then. This one should be pretty easy, I'm guessing, for you. Nice easy start. The old French custom called faire chabreau is diluting one's soup with red wine, serving the broth first, then the meat and vegetables. Diners skip around the dining table holding hands, or whoever gets the bay leaf does the dishes.
It's going to be number one. My grandfather used to do this every morning for breakfast. He would put red wine in his soup, and as a kid, you're watching this, you look... wanted to give back the breakfast.
I'm just amazed.
But he's already been up for 4 hours. He's been, you know, milking the cows, changing everything, and he would come, and his breakfast would always be, he would go to the marmite, and he would pull the bouillon into his bowl, and he would put pieces of old bread in there, and he would pour red wine right on top of this. I was like, and if you ever tasted that, it tastes just like it sounds.
I can't believe he's not alive anymore.
That's called faire chabreau.
And Terry is correct.
All right.
So, Terry, your next question. The Spanish braised beef dish, ropa vieja, translates to old rope, old clothes, old meat, or mean old woman.
Old rope.
No, it's actually old clothes. The Mexican stew called menudo is considered a good hangover cure. What is the main meat in it? Pork snout and ear, guinea pig, armadillo, or beef tripe?
Beef tripe.
That is correct. All right, Terry. Your 4th question. Japanese seem to be more adventurous eaters than Americans. For example, umesashi is fish spurn, fermented soy paste, horse meat sashimi, or still beating snake heart.
I'm going to go with the still beating snake heart, because that sounds like the most crazy thing in the world.
It does sound crazy, but that is not what it is. It is horse meat sashimi.
You know, I've had that, but I didn't know that was the name. Huh. Yeah.
This restaurant launched California cuisine in Berkeley, California in 1971. Was it Chez Panisse, Chez Jay's, Trader Vic's, or Spago?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Chez Panisse.
That is correct, and it was opened by Chef Alice Waters.
Correct. The Grand Dame of California.
Mm-hmm. So that
and Chef
is
Jeremiah
3
Tower.
Out of 5. Yep. All right, Terry, so you've got 3 out of 5. That is the score to beat. Katie, are you ready to go?
Let's do it.
All right. The first major U.S. aerosol food product was Cheese Whiz, Spray Spam, Olive Oil, or Ready Whip. And it's olive oil spelled O-Y-L, so you know it's not
real oil after all, it sounds like. I'm going to go with the
Popeye's
cheese.
Wife.
Olive oil?
Olive
you think
oil.
It, spray olive oil?
Yeah.
Nah. All I'm right. going to go with the cheese.
You're both wrong. It was, it was, in fact, the Ready Whip.
Darn it.
All right, Katie. Which food contains good cholesterol? Bacon, olive oil, avocado, or no food contains good cholesterol.
Is this one of those, like, cholesterol's just bad for us, Sarah? Is that the answer?
You know, is that what you're going to go with?
That's what I'm going to go with.
All right. So that is the answer, but not for that reason. So cholesterol is the same. There are good and bads in terms only to HDL and LDL cholesterol, which is in the body, not in the food itself.
Oh.
So all cholesterol is cholesterol. How many calories does licking a postage stamp produce? None at all. About 1 calorie, 2 to 10 calories, or 11 to 20 calories.
I'm going to go 2 to 10.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
It depends on the size of the stamp and the thoroughness of the lick. Champagne becomes a champagne cocktail by adding sweet vermouth, maraschino cherry, sugar cube, and Angostura bitters, or grenadine syrup.
It is the sugar and the bitters.
That is correct. And then you garnish with a twist of lemon.
Mm, if you're classy.
Mm.
And you got it.
No garnish for Katie.
Yeah, exactly. No bitters or sugar either, so I guess I'm just drinking the champagne.
Come on, hurry up. I need this now.
All right, Katie, your final question. The red liquid that oozes from a rare steak contains blood and water, water and hemoglobin, water and collagen, or water and myoglobin? It's actually water and myoglobin.
Oh.
The thing that isn't there is blood. All of the blood is gone. All right, but Katie, you still did so well. You did
Two out of five. That's not very good, but
it's
I'll
good.
Take it.
I mean,
hey,
it's better than Terry last week. So.
You missed it, but I had some very good questions last week. Very similar to yours.
All right, Tom, you ready to go?
I'm certainly ready.
All right, 2 out of 5 is the number to beat. Why do marinades tenderize meat? The sugar and salt bond to the tissues. It rehydrates cells. The soaking causes demyelinization, or the acids chemically weaken connective tissue.
Let's go with number 4.
Yes.
That is correct. And by the way, demyelinization is not actually a thing.
It's just a fake
made it
word.
Up.
Yeah.
Fake word. So I'm okay Tom with mispronouncing
that.
It. Tom, a blend of cinnamon, allspice, clove, nutmeg, and coriander is what? Famed quatre épices, or 4 spices used in pâtés and terrines, a basic curry powder, apple pie spice, or Jamaican jerk seasoning.
Yeah, so it's not Chinese spice.
Not the 5 spice.
I think it's the one for the pâté.
Yep, the quatre épices, that is correct.
Mm-hmm. Which is going to work because there is
5 spices.
Yeah.
Who knew?
This cocktail includes vodka, Cointreau, cranberry juice, and lime juice. Is it a daiquiri, a mojito, sex on the beach, or a cosmopolitan?
I think it's a cosmopolitan.
That is correct.
Yeah.
How many calories does the average person need to burn to lose 1 pound? 1,000, 2,500, 3,500, or 5,000?
To burn 1 pound?
Yes.
I'll say 5,000.
It is 3,500. All right, and your last question, Tom. Triple sec, orange juice, and champagne served in a fluted glass is a morning glory fizz, a dreamsicle, a mimosa, or a weeping cherry?
I will go with number 1.
It was actually a mimosa. I guess they just put some triple sec in.
Does anyone put triple sec in their mimosa?
No.
Yeah.
They never heard of fresh squeezed orange juice?
But that means Lisa gets to have happy hour at the Palace Kitchen.
Wow.
Nice job. If you'd like to be part of our show like Lisa, you can send us a note on Facebook or maybe even show up here and get picked at Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.